You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Good evening, everybody. I'm David McCoy. I'm a public health doctor. I work at Queen Mary University, London. I also work for a London-based charity called MedAct. And I'm a former trustee of the RSA, so it's a great pleasure to be back here. It's my great pleasure to introduce you to this evening's speaker, a friend and colleague, David Stuckler. David is an internationally renowned expert in global health. He is currently based at the Department of Sociology at the University of Oxford, where his research integrates political economy and health. He studied in the US before completing a PhD in Cambridge. There's many things I can say about David, but one of the things is that he is one of the most prolific researchers and authors in global health at the moment. And he's here today to discuss his new book, The Body Economic, Why Austerity Kills. This is the book, the product of about a decade's worth of research with his co-author, Dr. Sanjay Basu, who is a medical doctor based in the US and who is equally prolific and renowned. I've read David's book, and it confirms something that I've always believed in, which is that economics is too important to be left in the hands of economists. The same could be said about politics and politicians. So, without any further ado, over to you, David.
Well, David, thank you for that very kind introduction. It's a great pleasure to join you today to talk about a topic that we've been hearing about endlessly over the past 5 years. The recession, its impact on unemployment. People are still out of work, people have lost homes, and many remain mired in unpayable debt. 5 years since the Great Depression, the worst recession since the Great Depression began, we've had our politicians talking to us endlessly about debts and deficits. But what about the human costs of these responses? What about the impact of these economic changes on health? Together with my colleague, Dr. Sanjay Basu, we've been mining large data sets over the past decade to understand how large economic shocks affect people's health from the Great Depression through to the present crisis. And what we found, to give away our punchline, is that while recessions can hurt, what ultimately matters is how politicians respond. And when they respond to hardship with deep, indiscriminate cuts, they can turn economic suffering into severe epidemics. But by now you may be wondering, who is this Scottish boy depicted here? This is Kieran McArdle at the ripe age of 13. He's already bitter. He blames the government for killing his father. This is a severe charge. His father, depicted in the picture he's holding, Brian McArdle, had worked for 2 decades as a security guard in Lanarkshire, near Glasgow. But in 2011, just after Christmas, he suffered a severe stroke at the age of 57, leaving him paralyzed, blind in one eye, and unable to speak. It forced him to turn to the government for help to support his family. That government, in the hands of the coalition party, would prove no friend to the McArdles. In a drive to cut deficits created by the financial crisis and the bailout of banks, David Cameron, Prime Minister, went on a drive against welfare scroungers, people believed to be cheating the system. So they hired Atos, a French systems integration firm, to conduct fitness for work screenings, awarding a £400 million contract. Cameron's father, like several hundred thousand in the UK, were called in to be screened. Kieran's father, Brian, like many, was worried as he had heard that the screenings were being conducted in buildings that were not wheelchair accessible, often on the second floor. But he made it to the test and tried his best. A few weeks later, a brown envelope came through the post notifying Brian McArdle that his benefits had been cut. The next day, he dropped dead of a heart attack. It was extremely difficult as a public health researcher to understand the government's logic. What I have here is a data sheet from the Department for Work and Pensions estimating the cost of fraud among persons who are disabled receiving income support for conditions of entitlement. And as you can see, the amount of expenditure overpaid in the year that Karen's budgets were cut was estimated at around £2 million for conditions of entitlement, whereas the contract for ATAS was over £400 million. This and other responses to the economic crisis have been extremely difficult to understand outside the context of the politics of debt and austerity. What we do is look at natural experiments to try to understand what happens causally to people's health based on political decisions. And already, the economic effects of the austerity experiments unfolding across Europe and North America are becoming clear. Here I have the US and the UK, two countries that had large financial sectors, placing them at the center of the global banking crisis. And indeed, both suffered a major shock towards the end of 2008 after the fall of Lehman Brothers triggered a cascade that engulfed Europe's financial sector. And early on, President Barack Obama responded with a large stimulus package, investing more than $800 billion US to shore up social safety nets, protecting people from homelessness and helping people return to work. Whereas in the UK, under the coalition government in 2010, Chancellor Osborne began a large austerity drive, initially aiming to cut £83 billion from the budget. The consequences, as I said, are becoming clear. That marked a turning point in the UK's feeble recovery. And since the UK's economy has yet to recover, GDP coming back at a pace less than one-third of the US, which has returned to growth. I'm here to talk about health. There's a strong correlation of social welfare spending and life expectancy, all-cause mortality. What you can see is that societies that invest more in social welfare supports have better health outcomes. And as I'll show in this talk, this is not a mere correlation, but a powerful cause and effect relationship that manifests across societies and over time. To test our hypothesis that austerity hurts, we've looked at some of the test cases in Europe. Greece is arguably Europe's poster child of austerity. It suffered a large economic recession, had an initial demand shock from drying up of exports of olives, olive oil, and cotton. And early in the recession, tourists stopped coming to its shores. That alone would have been enough to tip most economies into recession. But Greece then faced another shock, a real number shock, as it was found that much of the Greek economic data was simply made-up numbers, spurred with the help of Goldman Sachs to hide away government deficits that led to Greece's fraudulent entry into the EU back in 2000. But in this climate of panic and uncertainty about the numbers, what ultimately has hurt Greece's economy has been a large austerity shock. In healthcare, Greece's politicians have placed the onus of the cuts. A journalist asked the health minister, Andreas Lovrides, in 2011, is it really true that you're looking to cut health budgets in the hospital sector by 40%? And the minister said, these cuts are difficult. They're not happening with a surgical scalpel, but with a butcher's knife, cutting both fat and lean. The impetus for these cuts were large bailout packages from the so-called Troika, the European Central Bank, the European Commission, and International Monetary Fund, aiming to meet a target of 6% health spending as a fraction of GDP. That's a level lower than Germany, which spends around 10%, the NHS, which spends less, around 8% of GDP, and the US, which spends 19%. It was not doctors or healthcare professionals who came up with the plan for restructuring Greece's health system, but economists. It's like trying to re-engineer your car without the aid of a car mechanic. Already, the consequences of these severe cuts are becoming clear. Greece is the only country in Europe to have suffered a large HIV outbreak. New infections have risen by more than 200%, not when the recession began, but beginning in 2010, 2011, 2012, when the cuts began to take effect. They've been concentrated in injection drug users, while some government officials have sought to divert attention to the HIV outbreak, focusing on immigrants. Primarily, it's occurred in persons of Greek origin. And the main program to prevent such outbreaks, called needle exchange programs, to make clean needles available to drug users, has been slashed. The World Health Organization estimates there should be about 200 clean needles per drug user per year. Street clinics estimate at the moment there are about 3. This is not the only outbreak. In a paper we published in The Lancet, we've documented a series of harms. After mosquito spraying budgets were cut, Greece suffered a return of malaria, which had previously been eradicated since 1974. As austerity drove youth unemployment up further to more than 1 in 2, now standing close to 60% of youth, we've seen a knock-on rise in suicides. Greece used to have one of the lowest rates of suicide in Europe. That figure, in our initial paper, we reported as a 60% rise. It's since doubled and continued to increase as more people have lost jobs from deep public sector cuts. Many of the job cuts have been in the health sector. More than 35,000 public health workers and doctors have lost their jobs from the austerity budget. The consequences are being felt by patients who find that public clinics are overrun and overstretched. Greeks are now turning to street clinics, originally designed to cater for immigrants, but now street clinics organized by Médecins Frontières are primarily catering to persons of Greek origin. And I could go on about this devastating set of statistics. Many of the outbreaks that Greece is facing will cost more to control HIV, malaria, tuberculosis than could have been to prevent. There's panic in clinics. One only needs to go to hospitals and vans that now outreach on the streets of Athens to persons who have lost access to care to see the problem. People who have relied on essential medicines are turning up to pharmacies to find them unavailable. As the government cut its pharmaceutical budget to meet deficit reduction targets, more than 200 medicines have been stopped from pharmacies, as covered by some brilliant investigative reporting. We're continuing our analysis. We've looked at other societies that experienced big economic crash. Here another test case is Iceland. If you were in the country in October 2008, your television program would have been interrupted by Prime Minister Gerhard, pictured here in his signature blue blazer. Block white letters came on the screen saying, "God bless Iceland." As Prime Minister Hard began his speech, all three of Iceland's biggest banks had failed. The worst banking crisis relative to the size of an economy ever recorded. Debt jumped to 800% of GDP, the biggest figure in North America and Europe, and Iceland, fearing national bankruptcy, had nowhere to turn but the International Monetary Fund for support. But then something unusual happened. More than 10% of Iceland's population took to the streets in protest against the plan to finance bankers' greed and recklessness with deep cuts to its budget. If an equivalent storm had happened here in the UK, it would be as though 6 million people descended on the House of Commons and House of Lords in protest of austerity. The health minister of Iceland at the time resigned rather than implement the 30% budget cuts to health that were being called for. And the president of this island nation took a radical step. He called for a public referendum, the first since 1944. In March 2010, 93% of Icelanders voted against large budget cuts to finance banker bailouts. Again in 2011, another referendum was held. That time, 60% of the population voted against it. Instead, Iceland's leaders boosted support in its healthcare system at a time of economic hardship to cope with the rising prices of imported medicines. And we found, thanks to these positive steps, no one in Iceland lost access to healthcare, even amid a terrible economic shock. That's not the only sign. Looking across markers of the society's health, we found no rise in suicides, no significant increase in depression among working-age men, the highest risk group. In fact, we've seen some counterintuitive benefits from the recession. McDonald's pulled out of the country, citing operational difficulties. There's been a decrease in fast food consumption. Instead, people are turning to locally sourced fish. Unemployed persons normally report elevated stress, but in Iceland they report an increase in sleep and lower stress levels as they're spending more time with their families. And in the World Happiness Report, the first published in 2011, Iceland, which was in 2006 rated as the happiest society in the world, once again came near the top of the list and was the leader in positive affect, one of the indicators for how happy people feel, in 2011. When the International Monetary Fund caught news of Iceland's unorthodox yet highly successful recovery, quickly turned tail, praising the results. The IMF has been the fastest nation to emerge from the economic recession. Last year, its growth was at 4% of GDP. Unemployment is below 5%, in stark contrast to Greece in the dotted line. Of course, these are two extreme cases. Greece, as a member of the European Union, part of the euro, doesn't have the same options to devalue its currency as Iceland. But the contrast shows that even a major economic crisis need not lead to an increase in death rates. Where does that leave the UK? Many of the cuts being pursued are just now beginning to take effect. And what we've seen in the 2011-2012 budget, here I've plotted it against an index of multiple deprivation, each dot in this plot is a different local area, is that these cuts are concentrated in the most deprived regions of the UK. Some of the early warning signs are being felt in areas of mental health. Some of you may have heard the tragedy of Miss Stephanie Bottrill, an elderly woman who had lived in subsidized housing 2 weekends ago. The bedroom tax led to an increase in her rent in a home she had been living in for more than 2 decades and in which she had raised her daughters, led to a 25% increase in tax, leaving her in an untenable position. Two weekends ago, she had packed up her belongings the eve before she was being forced to move out, and the next day, instead of leaving, she threw herself in front of a lorry. It's one tragedy of more than 1,000 excess economic suicides we've seen already in the UK's recession. Here are the numbers we published in the British Medical Journal, where you can see that suicides here in the red had been falling through 2007, just before the crisis, and with the rise in unemployment, began to spike again. I mentioned the UK had charted a feeble economic recovery before austerity measures took effect, and as unemployment fell briefly, so too did suicides, although remaining at a higher rate than before the crisis. What I haven't depicted here are the statistics just released from 2011, which show as unemployment rose again with deep public sector job cuts, so too have suicides been on the rise. Homelessness, another early indicator of the most vulnerable groups bearing the brunt of cuts, was falling through the foreclosure crisis and through the recession under the Labour government. Then, in 2010, following the first of cuts to social housing budgets, a part of which is the kind that led to the tragedy of Ms. Bottrill, we've seen a 40% increase in the UK in homelessness. It's too early to draw strong conclusions, but London has experienced rises in tuberculosis, often concentrated in homeless persons, drug users, and people who have a cluster of high-risk economic suffering. To further test our hypothesis that austerity is deadly, we have drawn on the benefit of historical crises to understand natural experiments. Why is it when faced with a similar economic shock do countries end up with widely varying outcomes, and what role do political choices play? In the early 1990s, in a case we cover in the second chapter of our book, Eastern Europe's economies began a transition to a market economy, unleashing a devastating mortality crisis of more than 3 million excess deaths. But what we found is that some societies were able to transition to the market without the human costs. Poland, Slovenia, and Belarus are three examples of societies that more gradually took steps to privatize their state-owned companies, while at the same time upholding their social protection systems. In contrast, Russia, Kazakhstan, and Latvia pressed for deep budget cuts to their health and social protection sectors, at the same time as massively dislocating millions of workers. The consequences can be seen in the figure here. Mortality rates in Russia and Belarus, neighboring countries that had followed similar mortality trajectories since the 1960s, but began to diverge for the first time, coinciding with the introduction of deep budget cuts at a period of economic hardship. We've also tested our hypothesis looking at the Great Depression in the U.S. And here you can see trends in mortality rates in the late 1920s, right when the Great Crash happened. What may come as a surprise to some of you is that even though suicide rates rose, overall, as you can see, mortality fell by about 10% in the Great Depression. It was a period where there was a lot going on at the time, but what we found is much of this drop came from a counterintuitive side effect of recessions. People drove less to save money on fuel costs. Road safety was a novel concept at the time. While this was one effect, what mattered substantially, we found, was again how politicians responded. For in the Great Depression, at a time when debt was 180% of GDP, President Franklin Roosevelt introduced a New Deal to the American people, including a works program administration, which helped 8.5 million Americans get back into jobs, a public housing program, which saved more than 1 million Americans from homelessness. And what we found was another a natural experiment, as some states that were red in the U.S., which is Republican, or blue, which is Democrat, went to differing degrees in implementing the New Deal. We saw it lead to a polarization in health outcomes across the nation, where those governors of U.S. states that introduced more relief spending, built hospitals, schools, expanded public health infrastructure, had reductions in suicide, significant drops in pneumonias, and declining infant deaths to a much greater degree than those governors that avoided the New Deal. And of the last crises I'd like to present, we see this pattern emerge again in the East Asian financial crisis, where in the late 1990s, Thailand's currency, the baht, dropped precipitously, engulfing soon East Asia's economies into a deep recession. Yet another natural experiment unfolded as Thailand and Indonesia turned to the International Monetary Fund for support and signing up for deep cuts to their HIV prevention programs, tuberculosis prevention programs, and other infectious disease control programs. But Malaysia opted a different course. And the contrast can be seen here, where Thailand had a flagship HIV program. After it was cut, it began to experience a large rise in infectious diseases that only now is recovering to the level it was before the crisis began. That wasn't witnessed in Malaysia as a control country. In 2012, only in this recession, the International Monetary Fund formally apologized to its East Asian borrowers, noting that the harms of its austerity advice was more than three times as great as had been previously assumed. Now, of course, not everyone agrees with our interpretation of the data. Looking to the British Medical Journal in November 2012, Greek economist Dr. Lyropoulos wrote in that no hard evidence has proven that crisis has become a health hazard, citing that the budget reductions in Greece were a positive result of improvements in financial management efficiency. We struggled to understand Dr. Lyropoulos' position because just that week, Dr. Mark Springer of the European Center for Disease Control had concluded from his trip of hospitals around the country that he had seen places where the financial package didn't even allow for the most basic of equipment. There were shortages of surgical gloves, and was raising the alarm for the spread of drug-resistant bugs in hospitals. Dr. Friedman, U.S. Director of HIV-AIDS Research, came to a similar conclusion that the Greek government were creating an epicenter for the spread of HIV in all of Europe. Again, we couldn't understand why Dr. Lyropoulos was defending the indefensible until we realized he was an advisory member for the Troika's health budget cuts and released his paper in the BMJ right when the bad news came out from Reuters. Even the International Monetary Fund has begun to turn tail on the program it's advised for Greece. Its chief economist, Olivier Blanchard, has now publicly said, "We underestimated the negative effect of austerity on job losses and the economy. They had assumed, without using hard data, that an obscure statistic known as the fiscal multiplier, that's the effect of government spending on the economy, was about 0.5. That would mean that austerity would be expansionary, that austerity would help the economy grow. A figure above 1 means austerity would be involutionary and shrink the economy. When the IMF re-estimated the multipliers, they found a multiplier of about 1.2. We've estimated a slightly higher multiplier from this recession of 1.7. But we went a step further, and we looked at how different types of government spending affect the economy, as depicted in this forest plot. And what we found is that investments in health, education, have some of the biggest returns on investment, some of the biggest economic bang for your buck, which is intuitive, because in overstretched systems, the money is rapidly absorbed to provide deep stimulus through jobs, purchasing power, all while providing valuable services that protect nations' health. In contrast, defense and bank bailouts tended to shrink the economy, having smaller and sometimes negative fiscal multipliers as money tends to exit the economy, ending up in offshore tax havens or going to foreign contractors. Yet, despite this evidence that has now become crystal clear that austerity is not helping economies recover in addition to its dire human costs, we see more austerity on the table. Greece's latest bailout extension is costing 32 billion euros on the condition of yet greater cuts to healthcare budgets. And this money has been found not to be flowing in to even support the Greek people, but circling back to banks in Germany, France, and the UK, among others. Just hammering the point home, what we found in this graph is that those countries that spent the most in this recession, opting for stimulus over austerity, have had a faster recovery, depicted here in the change in their GDP. So what I argue is there is an alternative to austerity, and one that we've seen in recessions present, but also past. At a time of arguably the greatest hardship in the UK post-World War II, Beveridge, in his landmark report, called to attack five giants in society, founding the welfare state in Britain at a time when debt was more than 200% of GDP. And Iron Bevan, on founding the NHS, noted that despite our financial and economic anxieties, we're still able to do the most civilized thing in the world, putting welfare of the sick in front of every other consideration. What we call for in Europe, in the UK, North America, is a New Deal that builds on the successes seen in the data from past and present responses to the crisis. And to be effective, it would follow three main principles. First, do no harm. This ancient law of higher healing, of the healing professions, should guide economic policy. Had austerity been run and organized like a clinical trial, it would have been discontinued given evidence of its deadly side effects. We should set up an Office of Health Responsibility, staffed with economists and epidemiologists, to monitor and disclose publicly the health effects of economic crisis and government choices. The second is to help people return to work. We should treat unemployment like the pandemic it is, a leading cause of suicides, alcoholism, depression, anxiety, to name a few. Politicians in Finland and Sweden that have managed the consequences of unemployment well through active labor market programs. These are programs that help people quickly return to work, setting up an action plan for doing so, have been able to prevent rises in depression and rises in suicides, even in periods of large rises in unemployment. And the last principle should come as no surprise to my colleague, Dr. McCoy, is to invest in public health. It's a wise choice in the best of times and an urgent necessity in the worst of times. Austerity in health is a false economy. Despite promises the NHS budget would be preserved, we've seen real cuts here in the UK. New York City officials in the early 1990s learned the lesson the hard way when they cut tuberculosis prevention budgets by $120 million, but just a few years later had a drug-resistant tuberculosis outbreak that cost more than $1.2 billion to control. What we've learned in our studies over the past decade is that severe, indiscriminate cuts to health and social protection are not only self-defeating, but fatal. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David. There's so much to discuss, not just from what you presented, but also what's in the book. I take home a key message that to some extent it's self-evident that austerity will be harmful to health. It involves budget cuts to health, to welfare, housing. But what's most interesting or most telling about your research is that austerity is also bad for economic health, that it has this negative impact in terms of hindering economic recovery. And that, for me, is the really important message that comes across from your analysis. And I was actually amazed reading in your book the IMF's use of the fiscal multiplier, that not only did they implement or they use a fiscal multiplier of 0.5 and apply it to a whole variety of countries, all of which are quite different with different contexts, but they applied the same fiscal multiplier to each and every sector, not recognizing that there will be a differential multiplier effect from sector to sector. Why is it that the IMF, with hundreds of economists and hundreds of researchers, failed to do the empirical research work that you and Sanjay did to demonstrate and illustrate that there is, in fact, a different fiscal multiplier and that it varies from sector to sector? Can you explain, is this incompetence or is this a willful ignorance? What is going on here?
It's a very good question. Surely, if you want to minimize damage to your economy, you need to know how different areas of government spending affect the economy differently. Our students wouldn't make the assumption, totally implausible, that all government spending is the same. It may in part reflect the priority that politicians and business leaders place foremost on gross domestic product, the pursuit of growth in a model above all, where health is sometimes relegated to an afterthought. And in your clinics with patients, and our work in public health, we're often picking up the pieces after it's too late.
Okay, so you're suggesting that it's this prioritization of economic growth, or this belief that austerity will promote economic growth.
It's interesting to look at the politics around austerity. I remember when Martin Wolf wrote in the FT early in the crisis that we're all Keynesians now, mainstream business press, saying that we had adopted for stimulus. That was true early on when it came to bank bailouts. But soon, much of the rest of Europe turned to austerity and cut budgets for everyone else.
I mean, I'm glad you mentioned the word politics, because the book title, you call it the body economic, and you explain how you derived that title from the more commonly used phrase, the body politic. But as I was reading your book, I thought this is actually as much about politics as it is about economics. And I wanted to illustrate that point by quoting directly from your book. In the case of Iceland, you said, "Icelanders were now faced with a profound moral question. To what degree, if any, were they as a people and a country responsible for the malfeasance of their business class? Iceland's taxpayers were being asked to pay for a private bank's bad investment decisions. This was serious news in a country where there was already a vast disparity between a rich few who had amassed a great debt through a lavish lifestyle and the rest who are now being asked to pay." So although there is an economic thesis behind your argument, it seems to me that there are profound moral and political questions about the distribution of risk in relation to the casino capitalism that we've seen over the last 10, 20 years. And also in reference to the way in which power, wealth is distributed and the negative impacts of austerity is felt across society. So I was intrigued by your title, Body Economic, and in spite of the fact that much of what you talk about is in fact about political choices.
Absolutely. For our democracies to work, we need to know the human costs of our economic policy choices. It's ironic that the former Prime Minister of Greece, George Papandreou, tried to put austerity to public vote and was soon after ousted from office before it went through. So just as Europe's leaders were praising the development of democracy after ousting Colonel Gaddafi on the southern shore of the Mediterranean, it appears that they were blocking it on the northern shore.
Now, I'm sure if Naomi Klein had read your book, and probably she will get round to it at some time, she will argue that austerity is not just about the achievement of economic recovery, but that there may be underlying it a separate set of objectives and agendas, including the privatization of public assets and public services and public goods. Do you know if she's read your book, and any comments on what she might say about it?
She's tweeted some of our findings on Twitter that we've published in leading medical journals over the past 5 years and more. Turning back to the example at the beginning of the talk of the McArdles, the cuts to disability budgets are not saving money. They're not helping economic recovery, so what else could it be if not ideological? There's a concern that for some people, the crisis is an opportunity to shrink the role of the state, avoiding paying into a system that they never use anyway in the case of wealthy elites.
Great. Well, again, thanks, David, for your work. I'm going to open up the floor to any questions.
Hiya, Dawn Foster from The Guardian. When I've written about exactly the same thing, so recently Greece, I spoke to a researcher in Greece who said that he'd managed to map heart attacks with the economic crisis, and he said that he'd seen, especially in people who didn't normally have heart attacks, such as women and younger men, heart attacks had spiked like exactly, you know, completely in line with the economy. And when I argued that this clearly shows that austerity harmed public health, and you know, economic measures did impact public health, what I found was that right-wing people who were advocates of austerity, just simply argued that poverty causes, you know, health inequality, and you have to accept that, and that you can't necessarily tie it to austerity. So how would you argue against that in a relatively easy way to, you know, put these people to get them to be quiet?
Yeah. We're hearing similar arguments here in the UK. Ministers have been saying that it's far too early to draw conclusions from the data. Yet the Department of Health, in looking at suicides, uses three-year averages, which make the spikes, the ups and downs with unemployment that I shared with you, look like a smooth curve. So the answer is to look at the data, which are crystal clear.
First, I want to say how terrific it is for you to make this contribution. The research you're doing is really great. I can't figure out whether what your research is looking to say, that health it's a health economics versus an economics pure and simple. I mean, if, for example, in Greece, if you had the Greek government investing in public health, you would have had those health indicators going the other way or not being as severe. So is that the main message, or is it, are you really taking on the whole economic case against austerity?
Our main argument is that recessions can hurt, but austerity kills. That many of the wanton budget cuts have impeded health while slowing down recovery. And we see that there is an alternative, that when people and their health are placed at the center of economic recovery, it can pave the way for a happier, healthier future, as happened in the UK in the post-war period.
Patrick Shine from the Shaftesbury Partnership. Thank you so much, and there's so many aspects in what you've touched on. I was thinking about if you've got any insights into the role of civil society institutions, and I'll give a specific. I'm very closely associated with the Food Bank Network, which has got great data about people coming into crisis and how it works. And so what comes through is an awful lot of people are in crisis because of screw-ups. It's not the big picture, it's not the policy, it's the execution by local branches of people, which are differential and random. And so quite a lot of charities working around homelessness and crisis are very quickly getting leading data. But of course, how to engage people, a political process that's invested hugely in the universal credit is another matter altogether.
Thanks for that comment. Lady in the green, yes.
Yeah, Teresa Martin, Cambridge. Thanks, David. It's a really eloquent account. For me, what this draws attention to are the different epistemologies that underlie different disciplines. And so you're bringing your expertise in population health sciences, public health, which is evidence-based, and shining a light on economics, which has a very different idea of what is knowledge. And I think that there's somewhat of an irony that the government has recently set up several What Works centres, looking at education, crime, trying to build on the success of NICE, and perhaps the What Works centre that we really need is one that focuses on economics policies.
It's a great idea.
It was quite gloomy what you painted, but Some of the example with Iceland, how Donald's kind of withdrew. Are there any other examples of actually some benefits that might actually come out of what we're going through?
You mentioned road traffic deaths falling in Ireland, hit hard by the crisis as people drove less. Road traffic deaths hit record lows. Politicians were quick to attribute them to advances in road safety, but they likely had more to do with the recession itself. Other counterintuitive benefits are harder to understand with regard to diet as people respond in complex ways. We've seen some groups turn to eating more at home in response to the recession to save money, while others have turned to cheap junk food. And this is a beautiful illustration of resilience. Why is it that some people, when faced with a similar economic shock, respond in healthy ways and others in unhealthy ways? In the United States, we did studies looking at alcohol use in the recession and found that there were about 850,000 Americans who started to abstain from alcohol in the recession. But in contrast, there are about 750,000 Americans who started binge drinking dangerously in response to unemployment. We need to understand what tips people in different directions and try to support, if we can, making healthier choices easier choices.
And Andrew Kluth, I'm a fellow. I was struck by one of the slides you had where you were showing the return on investment of £1 in certain areas, and you commented, and it was very evident there, that investing in culture and the environment were both investments which were significantly better than investing in many other areas. And we're having another debate running alongside this one here around measures of growth, real growth, and whether or not the global crises we're facing around climate change and sustainability generally are because we are measuring growth in the wrong way. Can you infer anything or deduce anything or suggest any interesting research questions around the evidence you've found about where the best returns are for the pounds invested in your research compared with you know, the possibility of directing investment in the future in areas which are genuinely more sustainable?
Two quick points there, and it links back to the previous point. There have been found to be some counterintuitive benefits from the environment. As the economy and production slowed, so too did carbon emissions in the short term. I'm not an expert on the environment. But I think what our data show in the fiscal multiplier is just scratching the surface, that we need to apply rigorous standards of evidence that we have in medicine and public health to answer some of our most pressing social, economic, and environmental questions. I often think back to Robert Kennedy's quote in the U.S. during his 1968 presidential campaign before he was assassinated, that too often we fetishize GDP. It captures tobacco, cancer care, renal dialysis, but fails to capture the joy of a child's play, and specifically everything we have that makes life worthwhile. Thanks for raising that point.
So it does seem then, David, that economic growth is not a prerequisite to improved health and well-being. And if improved health and well-being is the goal of social and public policy, why indeed do we fetishize economic growth?
If you step back and we're an alien looking on our society, it looks like we've got our priorities backwards. And that's, again, revealed in our book, which approaches the recession and the choices policymakers have made through the lens of health. We can use health data to judge our success and failure in economic policy.
And social policy.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Cameron Stocks. I'm from Medicine UK, the UK's Global Health Student Network. This is an excellent statement and an excellent piece of evidence on the impact on health of austerity. But there's already in the academic world a movement away from austerity anyway, with you know PhD students discrediting major pieces of work. But none of this is filtering through to policy. So how can we catalyze the change in policy, and how will this contribute?
Yes, as you point out, the intellectual foundations of austerity have been shot out of the water. With the Reinhardt-Rogoff scandal to which you alluded, where it found one of the main pieces of evidence that bolstered austerity was found to have arisen from a spreadsheet error. And when the error was corrected, the finding that debt above 90% was a danger to recovery vanished. That, together with the International Monetary Fund's look at the fiscal multiplier, again, has shown that the conditions have changed. Politically, then, it's a question of how evidence gets into policy. And this week, the International Monetary Fund has come to the UK suggesting that Chancellor Osborne should relax austerity. The IMF, given its past recommendations, might not be the right vehicle for delivering that message. But I think we can all call on our governments to take a hard look at the data and use a data-driven approach to guide our society to a healthier economy.
So your book really contrasts stimulus with austerity and the use of deficit spending to promote stimulus and trust that with the effects of austerity. You don't mention the option of debt default as another mechanism for addressing the financial crisis. And I know that's not the subject of your book, but I wondered if you have any thoughts on that as being an alternative policy instrument.
I haven't looked at the cases of defaulting on debt in more detail. Many of them have occurred in sub-Saharan Africa in the 80s and 1990s. What I can say is that standard macroeconomic advice is that you save during the good times and spend during the bad. There's a need for, in a way, a spender of last resort when demand is deflating the situation we're in now. That means economic crises are opportunities to use stimulus spending to achieve lasting benefits to the triple bottom line and health, the social benefits, and the environment. I worry we're passing up that opportunity, almost, but not yet.
I'd like to invite all of you to give another round of applause to David for his presentation and his work.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.